There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Believe is brought to you by Cryptid Coffee Co. Use promo code BELIEVE on checkout for 10% off their Angry Yowie coffee blend. Head over to cryptid.com.au to check them out.
It was just the most massive thing I've ever seen. To tell you the honest truth, I thought, well, we're the only ones left on this planet. Something's happened. We've missed something here.
The fear that went in me when I seen it was just the feeling. I'd say it was fear, but I've never felt that feeling before in my entire life.
It's a weird feeling, like you can't explain it when you don't know. You feel like you're being followed, but you don't know what it is.
We had two to our right, another one in front of us, another one to the left, and another one just across the road, shaking the daylight out of the tree. All we get was a big red eye.
I remember waking up and looking at the end of the bed, and there was a figure there, almost insect-like, and then I blacked out.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Cade Moyer, and you are listening to the Believe Paranormal and UFO Podcast. If you have had an encounter and would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to leave us a rating or review wherever you listen and head on over to our website, believepod.com, and consider becoming a member to get bonus episodes and video content. Tonight I'm joined by George Simpson, and he's the author of the book Nothing on Radar, The Valentich Mystery. George, welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mate, it's a real pleasure to have you on because, you know, you and I have been chatting on Facebook for a little bit there, and your book is truly fascinating. It's really one of Australia's greatest UFO mysteries. And, you know, Australia really doesn't have a lot of great UFO mysteries. There's a handful out there that are kind of famous. But this one is one of the biggest head scratchers when it comes to what actually happened on that very mysterious day. So I guess my first question for you kind of off the bat is, what got you into this mystery from the start?
Okay, well, it was just by being in the right place at the right time, I guess. I was on the day that this happened, the day that Fred took off at Moorabbin. I was 20 years old. I was living with my parents at that stage, and I was just waiting for a friend who was coming to visit at about 6 o'clock. She hadn't arrived yet, so I went out to the front yard to see if there's anybody coming down the street, and I saw this plane fly past, which is nothing unusual for us. We saw lots of planes flying around because we weren't that far, really. Like, by air, we were 4 or 5 minutes from Moorabbin Airport. So, you know, if you took off at Moorabbin and then turned and flew for a minute or two, you'd go right over where we lived. So we saw a lot of air traffic, you know, all the time. Well, I saw this plane going past, and it was the time of day when there are a lot of tall trees in that area in Balmoris. There's a lot of tall, shady trees. So the street was starting to get a little bit on the dark side, but the sky was still blue and the lights had been in the sunshine in the evening. It was only about 6 p.m. and it was in October. So, you know, it's nowhere near sunset yet. But I watched the plane go past. It's just a blue and white Cessna flying past. I could tell it was blue and white. And a thought popped into my mind. I could say, look, I heard a voice. I don't know that I heard a voice, but it was like a thought popped into my mind, which was, don't your eyes off that plane. Keep your eye on that plane. And I thought, well, that's before. But I watched the plane. It was going in a straight line. It was nothing unusual, but it was heading toward the setting sun, which wasn't setting yet, but it was only just after 6 o'clock. The sunset would have been in just before 7 p.m. that evening. Anyway, I didn't think much more about it. The next day, there were radio news reports on the radio saying that an aircraft has gone missing. And they believe this plane has run out of fuel and crashed into Bass Strait. And so there was a search going on, an air sea rescue search going on. And that was what the news report said all day long. But by the end of the day, this is the next day, I think it was a Saturday when I saw the plane go over. The next day was a Sunday. And by the end of the Sunday, the news reports had changed from, we think this plane has run out of fuel and gone down into the sea, to this pilot reported that something was chasing him. There was an object he could not identify, which was flying around him and annoying him. And then he disappeared. He and his plane disappeared. That's, for me, that was an amazing kind of report to hear, because I've never heard of anything like that before. You know, you occasionally get UFO reports on the radio, but very rarely do you ever hear of one where a pilot who's up there with this thing flying around sees it, can't identify it, and then vanishes. That's quite unique.
It really is unique, and there's so many different types of evidence that kind of go along with this encounter that it really does give a lot of credence to the fact that, you know, there was possibly something otherworldly that interacted with Frederick that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's just odd that I got that strange feeling that I should keep my eye on the plane. I mean, if you thought about it logically, if I was to keep my eye on the plane, I would have had to jump in my car and then go speeding along Beach Road through all the traffic to keep my eye on the plane. I would have had to follow it all the way around. I would have had to drive down past Geelong and get on the Great Ocean Road. There's no way I could have kept my eye on the plane. The Royal Melbourne Golf Course was at the end of our street. I mean, they had very tall trees, and it just disappeared behind the trees as it flew off. It would have gone over, from where I lived, it would have gone over a big shopping centre called the Concourse. It would have flown over, that's in Bob Morris, it would have then gone over Ricketts Point. And then the plane would have gone in a straight line across the bay to Indented Head, and it would have passed over the southern area of Geelong and gone past West Geelong, then Anglesey, and then right down along the Great Ocean Road. Because Fred was heading straight down to Cape Otway, because that's where the lighthouse is, and that's where you turn south to go down to King Island, because that's where he was going.
Yeah, it is such a interesting encounter, and the thing that I find just so haunting about it is the fact that we've got a version of a recording of what happened, because in your book it's kind of revealed that the original recording is almost an impossible thing to get our hands on in our current day and age. But kind of small snippets of it have kind of made it out to the public, and they've kind of been re-recorded in their own ways to kind of fill in those blanks. But in your book, you do have a copy of the transcript of what was said that day. Do you happen to have that on you by any chance?
Yep. So we can go through what was said, hey, when Fred had this encounter.
Yeah, absolutely, because this is a rather famous UFO case over here in Australia, and it really did. It got a fair bit of international attention, but some of our listeners may not be overly aware of the context of what happened. But if you can go through that transcript, okay, that would provide a lot of information.
Yeah, it does, really, yeah. So look, what happened was, Fred, after I lost sight of the plane, Fred continued down to Cape Otway, and then he was, that's where they all go, because when you're flying along next to the ocean, you tend to stay over the land. In case you need to come down in an emergency, you can land somewhere on solid ground. So, you follow the coast. But then, eventually, if you're going to cross over Bass Strait and go down to Tasmania, you do have to cross the Bass Strait. You have to cross the ocean. And Fred had done this a couple of times before, but this was his first. His return flight would have been a night flight, but it was not nighttime yet. Now, the trouble is a lot of the skeptics say, he was flying at nighttime, and it's very easy to be disorientated when you're flying in the dark. It wasn't dark, not yet. A return flight might have been, but it wasn't dark yet. So anyway, he's got to Cape Otway, and he has radioed. He has said, Melbourne, this is DSJ. I'm at Cape Otway and continuing to King Island. And that was acknowledged. Steve Robey was the air traffic advisor in air services, and he heard that and he said, DSJ Melbourne, roger that. Basically, he just said, DSJ Melbourne. It was acknowledged with the call sign. Delta Sierra Juliet was the registration of the plane. Delta Sierra Juliet. So Fred just then headed down from Cape Otway for another about 6 minutes. And in that time, he's covered about a third of the distance from the mainland to King Island. It's a fair way. It's about a half an hour flight directly south from Cape Otway. And of course, there's a lot of other people flying around and communicating with their services at the same time. And they're having normal communications. Funny thing is, whenever Fred is speaking on his radio from now on, when he communicates, there's a kind of a background interference coming through whenever Fred talks. But not when he was at Cape Otway, but once he's reporting after he's flown 6 minutes across the ocean. And his first thing is, he goes, Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. Is there any known traffic below 5,000? And he says, Delta Sierra Juliet, no known traffic. And then he says, Delta Sierra Juliet, I have, seems to be a large aircraft below 5,000. And then the reply is, Delta Sierra Juliet, what type of aircraft is it? He says, Delta Sierra Juliet, I cannot affirm, it is four bright, it seems to me like landing lights. And he gets the reply, Delta Sierra Juliet. And then a minute or so later, Fred says, Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. The aircraft has just passed over me at least 1,000 feet above. And so he gets the reply, Delta Sierra Juliet, roger, and it is a large aircraft, confirm. The answer he gets is, unknown due to the speed it's travelling. Is there any Air Force activity in the vicinity? Any Air Force aircraft in the vicinity? So this is going so quickly, he's thinking it must be a jet or something, And the answer is, Delta Sierra Juliet, no known aircraft in the vicinity. And he says, Melbourne is approaching now from due east towards me. And he gets to reply, Delta Sierra Juliet, so that's acknowledged. Then it says on the transcript, it says, open mic for 2 seconds. So what Fred's done is he's held the mic and he's gone to say something and no words have come out. But during that 2 seconds, you hear this static sort of noise coming over the radio. And to me, it sounds like if I had an industrial sewing machine running in my bedroom and I was on the phone and I had this machine running, you'd pick it up on the phone. You'd hear this clickety-clickety-clickety noise. That's the sort of sound. It's an unusual sound, the background sound. And he says, Dr. Sierra Juliet, it seems to me that he's playing some sort of game. He's flying over me 2-3 times at a time at speeds I could not identify. And the answer he gets is, Dr. Sierra Juliet, roger, what is your actual level? He says, my level is 4,500. Delta Sierra Juliet, and confirm you cannot identify the aircraft. Affirmative. And he says, affirmative. Delta Sierra Juliet, roger, stand by. there's a lot of information there. It's flying over me at 2-3 times at a time. At speeds I cannot identify. I don't know anything that can do that. That's kind of strange. That's like a helicopter blade would go over you at very many times per second. But I don't know anything else that could do that.
Yeah, the movement that's described, it's just so unnatural and just so impossible by known aircraft at that time, let alone today.
That's right. And also, he can't identify what it is. He's saying it's going so fast. He says it's got such speed that he can't identify it. He just says it's like landing lights and it's bright and it's big and it's fast. And there is this interference coming over the radio, which confirms there's something unusual going on. Then he says, Melbourne Delta Sierra Juliet, it's not an aircraft, it is. And then he doesn't say anything. There's just this noise coming through the radio. So he's saying, it's not an aircraft, it's... And then he can't think of the words to describe actually what it is, because he's having trouble describing it. Now, the cover of the book is this photograph taken by somebody who was down at Cape Otway and took this photo of the sunset, and he captured this unusual object. And that's why I've used that on the cover of the book, because that was taken at the time on the day that Fred disappeared. And this was taken only about 20 minutes before Fred flew past into this area. But that's known as the Roy Manifold photo. It's on the cover of the book. It's a very odd shape, and you would have trouble describing it. It's typically like a child's top, kind of curved at the bottom and sloping sides going up and like almost flat on top. But in this photo, it's got kind of an odd shape sticking out of the top as well, and like a jet of steam or moisture or something coming out of it. And it's got sort of blue sparkles around it in the air, blue sparkly dots in the sky, which were not in the photo before or after. And Roy was taking photographs every 30 seconds, timing it off his watch, secondhand. He wanted 30-second intervals of the setting sun. He was shooting off the last 6 shots on his camera. And he wasn't looking through the camera when he was taking them. He'd set the lens on infinity, set the camera at the setting sun, and then he was just timing his watch, looking at his watch, and every 30 seconds just clicking the release button on the camera. It had a motor drive. It was an Olympus camera OM1 or OM2 with a motor drive. So he was just clicking off the shots to use up the rest of his film.
And this photo, I'll include a copy of it on our show notes episodes, because it truly is fascinating. Like, The thing is, you work in a photo lab, you kind of know what can be manipulated and what can't. And the thing is, this was done in a time when photo manipulation was extremely difficult. Like, to produce something like this, he would have to do something like a double exposure or something like that on the camera. And to do that on film and not actually ruin the photo completely back then, extremely difficult to do. And the thing is, it's not just this craft. You do see how there's almost like this interference or something going on around it. There's so much to this image that it feels like it would have been impossible to fake in that day and time.
Well, one of the you know, when you look at a court case or a criminal case, you have chain of evidence. You know, when you have things like bullet cartridges and things that could get handled or mishandled, you have a thing called chain of evidence, right? Now, Dr. Richard Haynes of NASA says that when it comes to photography and UFOs, you've got to know about the role of film and the order the photos were taken in. Do they match what was going on in the person's life at the time? Like, you put the film in your camera, you take some photos of the dog or something at home, you go off on your holiday, you take a few shots of things on the way, you get to the place you're staying, you take photos of where you're staying, then he's taken these sunset photos, and then he's, you know, do they all follow a logical sequence when you look at all the negatives on that film? They did. That's one of the little rules that that Haynes sort of talked about when he gave a talk about this case. He mentioned other cases where people had UFOs that they'd photographed. There was no photos in between of making the model of the UFO and then test shots where they threw it in the air and it went the wrong way. You know, people would, if you can see all the negatives, you can get an idea of whether or not this is made up or not. Now, what happened in this case with Roy Manifold, who took the photo, he didn't notice it when he was taking it because he was looking at his watch and he wasn't even looking through the camera. And it wasn't until a month later that they just went and got their film developed. When they got the photos back, they found this image in the photos. And they thought, no, hang on. Those people that developed our film, they've mucked it up. They've got this big splodge in my sunset photo. And he said to her, where did you get this developed? And she said, oh, just down at the local place, which was, I think there was a number of different photo labs around at those times. And there was one called Pacific Photos, which is sort of in all the shopping centres. And Roy had this idea that Pacific had somehow just damaged the negative or something. So he went to them and said, look, I've got this weird thing in my photo. What is it? And they said, we don't know what it is. And he said, well, what's happened? You know, when you've developed the film, you know, what's going on? They said, it's not our fault. There's nothing wrong with the film. And there's nothing wrong with our processing. We don't damage people's negatives when we do, when we make prints, you know. So he had to accept what they said, but he still wasn't satisfied. And the film he was using was Kodak film, and he lived in Templestowe, and Kodak's not that far away from him in Coburg. So what he's done is he's gone to the Kodak laboratory, which is the Australian headquarters of Kodak Australia. He's gone there, taken the film, showed them the negatives and said, look at this, and showed them the photos and said, what is this? What's going on here, guys? So their lab technicians looked at it under a microscope and they said, no, there's nothing wrong with the film. There's no developing error. There's no emulsion error. That's something that you've captured. You've captured something that was in the air. We don't know what it is either, but that's... On this photo, if you look at it, you can see the grain of the film. That is the reaction of the grain of the film to whatever was out there. It's not no damage to the emulsion layers or anything. And that was confirmed by Kodak. And strangely, when he was there, they said, could you leave that negative with us so we could do further analysis on it? And Roy said, I don't know, I'll take it back then. I'll take it with me now. So... I'm glad he did, otherwise it would have been lost forever, possibly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, this is a month after there's been all the stuff in the papers about Fred disappearing because the plane went missing in October, and it wasn't until November, like the 4 weeks later, that they got their film developed. So that just shows you that it wasn't a hoax. He was in no hurry to get his photos developed or anything. He just took the photos of the setting sun. He didn't know he'd captured... probably one of the greatest UFO photos ever taken, related directly to probably the greatest aviation mystery that's ever happened in Australia. He had no idea.
Yeah. And this is the thing I find so fascinating about this whole type of mystery is the fact that there's all these funny little connections that you almost have at a personal level, and it kind of blows my mind.
Well, look, how about we just quickly run through the rest of this transcript so everybody gets to hear the rest of it, and then we'll go on to that all that other stuff. Yeah,
that sounds great. Let's do it.
Sound good? All right, okay. So he said, look, it's not an aircraft. It is, and then he had no words to describe, because if you look at that photo, yeah, it's hard to describe. So then he's asked by Steve Roby in Air Services, Delta Sierra Juliet, Melbourne, can you describe the aircraft? And so Fred says, Delta Sierra Juliet, as it's flying past, it's a long shape. And then the mic is open for 3 seconds. He's having another look. And then he says, I cannot identify more than that. It gets such speed. And the mic's open for another 3 seconds, and then he says, it's before me right now, Melbourne. And the answer is Delta Zero Juliet, Roger. How large would the object be? And he says, Delta Zero Juliet, Melbourne, it seems like it's chasing me. What I'm doing now is orbiting, and the thing is just orbiting on top of me also. It's got a green light. It's sort of metallic-like. It's all shiny on the outside. Now, chasing me, that didn't get into the transcript when that got into the papers. They changed that to, it seems like it's stationary. But he said, it seems like it's chasing me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because that sounded too sinister to put that in the papers. Anyway, you got the reply, Delta Zero Juliet. Then the mic's open for another 5 seconds with more of this noise. And then he goes, Delta Zero Juliet, it's just vanished. And they acknowledge that, Delta Zero Juliet. And then he calls with a question. He says, Melbourne, would you know what kind of aircraft I've got? Is there certain military aircraft? So he's thinking it. There must be something that can move really... It's odd that he doesn't know about, but it's very fast. It must be a military thing. So Steve says to him, Delta Zero Juliet, confirm the aircraft just vanished. He says, say again. He says, Delta Zero Juliet, is the aircraft still with you? He says, Delta Zero Juliet, it's nor... And there's... Nor south, approaching from the southwest. So, because he's been going around in a big circle, he's actually no longer going to King Island. He's started to go around in a circle so he can keep an eye out and look for where this thing is. It's gone over him at 1,000 feet above. It's disappeared. It's come back. And it's going very quickly. He doesn't know what it is. And so when he's trying to work out which direction it's coming from, he's got to get his own bearings first because he's been going around in circles for a few minutes. He says, oh, it's now approaching from the southwest. And that gets acknowledged, Delta Zero Juliet. Then Fred says, Delta Zero Juliet, the engine is rough idling. I've got it set at 2324 and the thing is coughing. Now, 2324, that's 23. These aviation experts tell us that when you're running a cruise altitude, cruise speed, and you're just cruising along, 23 refers to 23 inches. Inch pounds of pressure, manifold pressure in the carburation system of the plane. So 23 is the proper running of the engine. It's sucking. It's got 23 pounds of pressure, so that's dragging the fuel through the system. And 24, meaning it's 2400 RPM, which is a normal... sort of, you know, when you're going around the freeway in your car, you might be going 2400 RPM. Yeah, so he's cruising gently and everything, and everything's fine, but his engine's coughing at that kind of rev range, which is very unusual. And so Steve says, okay, well, Roger, what are your intentions? Now, I think he misinterpreted the question at that point, because what Steve is thinking, this plane's now about halfway to King Island, over Bass Strait, about halfway there. What's the best thing for you to do? To get back to the mainland and try to land, or get to the island and try to land? Because you've got in. He's saying the engine's coughing. And Fred just says, oh, look, my intentions are to go to King Island. Melbourne, a strange aircraft is hovering on top of me again. And then he's for a few seconds. It is hovering, and it's not an aircraft. So Steph says, Delta Sierra Juliet. And then he says, Delta Zero Juliet, Melbourne. And as he's talking, all of a sudden he's cut off with this strange metallic sound, which has been, that came out on about 2013 on the Unexplained Files. They interviewed Dr. Richard Haynes in America, and he played the tape recording of that metallic sound, the actual sound from the tape, which is what I've been describing as sort of a funny noise that was coming through the radio, but now it was a bit louder and it had a clicking, rhythmic clicking sound to it. And nobody's been able to, people can only guess what that might be, that clicking sound. But and Steve tried to call him a few times and never got a reply after that, so there was never any response. Now, that's the end of that. There was no more.
It would have been so terrifying for this poor young man to be alone and kind of just go through this absolutely unexplainable experience and not really have any support from anywhere to kind of validate what he's seen. And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Also, are you wanting more content? Why not become a Believe Plus member? You'll get access to exclusive podcasts and episodes that aren't available to the public. Not only that, you'll also get our regular feed without any ads. Head to believepod.com/plus to sign up today for just $5 a month.
Yeah, well, I was talking to Steve about it and he said, look, it's kind of strange because you're talking to somebody over a two-way radio, but all you have is a microphone and a speaker. You know, you're in communication, but you can't really do anything. It's a very helpless situation for both of you to be in. You know, they're at the other end saying, I'm seeing this thing, I don't know what it is. Are there any aircraft like this? And, well, he couldn't see what Fred was seeing. But Fred was giving a description, but it was hard to describe it. And then he just pit, and they never recovered the plane, or Fred, or anything. And many, many years after this had happened, a very unusual new chapter in the story kind of came forward. Bill Chalker is a UFO researcher, a very well-known UFO researcher in New South Wales. Bill's been a UFO researcher for, 30, 40 years or more, and everybody, he's well known internationally as Australia's leading UFO researcher. He's held that mantle for a very long time. Now, he was doing a lot of UFO investigations in the 1990s. They had a lot of sightings around there, and he decided there were so many. He grabbed his mate Rob, and the two of them went to Coonabarabran to investigate. There was a lot of houses to visit, a lot of people to visit who'd reported these UFO sightings. And while they were going through this process, many of them said, oh, you've got to go and talk to Laurie. You must go and talk to Laurie in town. Now, this guy called Laurie Ryder, who ran the local hardware store. Now, what he did, he was very interested in UFO reports, and there was a lot going on in the area at the time. And he used to ask his customers to write down to tell him about their experiences, and he would write down in a journal all these UFO reports that came in. And so that was very interesting. And he said, look, he had hundreds of them over the years. He said, yeah, but he said the most interesting one of the lot was a farmer that had come in who had moved to Coonabarabran from South Australia. He said, this farmer came in. Now, I've actually got his story in the book. There's a chapter on him called Laurie, and it's about his story. Now, if I just quickly get to the right page, I can tell you what Laurie reported, and it's on the tape, and we've got a copy of this tape recording that Bill made when he was interviewing Laurie Ryder. It's a very interesting little story, and it was the day after Fred had gone missing, but it was in Adelaide the next morning. Now, have you ever heard about this?
I have. And it is an absolute head spin because I'm not going to take away the glory of it. But when I did read this in your book, I was absolutely blown away because it is just this absolute obscure piece of the puzzle.
Well, I'll play the part of Laurie. But this is what Laurie said on the tape when he was being interviewed by Bill Chalky. He said, "Yeah, there was a mixed bag," he said, "but the most interesting one of the lot is this farmer came into the shop. He pulled up outside one of these little ag bikes, you know, like sewing machines. Now, I had a bit of a grin to myself. I've had about 15 or 16 motorbikes, and I've still got about four. I'd kick myself for selling me Vincent, you know, but anyway, it's done now. Anyway, I thought, you know, riding one of those little sewing machines." And yeah, he got off and scratched himself and he got his clothes off and that, and he came into the shop to get something, I think a gas cylinder filled or something. Anyhow, I mentioned his bike and what did he do, you know, and I always ask people these things. Down near Adelaide, he bails Lucerne. He had a property down there in South Australia. And at the time, there were military manoeuvres on down that way somewhere, and he was baling hay. And he said the bearing in the baler started to scream and make a noise, and he'd been having some trouble with it, so he thought, oh, no, not this again. So he stopped and put the baler out of gear and dismounted from the tractor and turned around, and the baler had stopped, but the noise was still going. And he said, "I was trying to come to grips with this for a minute." He said, "And then I became aware of a shadow," and he looked up, and he said he was under a big saucer, he called it. And he said, going from the length of the baler and the tractor, it would have been about 90 feet in diameter. So that's about 30 metres, right? He said, and was kind of, as he's flown an aircraft and he gets his crops done, he knows when an aircraft is about to stall. And he thought, "Strip, this thing's going to drop on me." So he ran out from the side to the side of the paddock, out from underneath it. But looking up, he said, looking under it, it kind of came in and went up. It was dark. He couldn't see anything. But the most remarkable part was, you know, on merry-go-rounds, at shows, they have the horses, they have stacked wide. They've got these little wooden lats. Have you noticed them? They're nailed onto it so you don't slip over.
Mm.
About an inch or half an inch by an inch, and there's a gap, and then there's another one. They're all around the edge. He said, well, it was like that underneath, but there were two rows of them. Now, if you could blink, you could see one row which was rotating very fast. But the other one wasn't, and it was that this were counter rotating, or it was rotating in the opposite direction, but very slow. You could see it quite plainly, and he said as it moved slowly along, it kind of came up, and there was a piece sticking out of the top like a dome. That around the bottom of the dome appeared to be a black seal of some kind, just what he took it to be, like a weather seal or something. And he said the dome had like a church door in it with an arched top. But there were no windows that he could see, no handle on the door or anything. And he said on what he took to be the rear of it, there were slight protrusions that he would call rudders and two big round holes. And he said there was shivering heat coming out of one and the other one, and little spurts of flame coming out of it. And he gained the impression that one engine wasn't working, you know, because one disc wasn't spinning. And then, as he cleared it, he said the most remarkable thing of all, there was a Cessna airplane stuck to the side of it.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
The whole aeroplane. And he said, the aeroplane, the tops of the wings were flat against the side of it, and the tail was kind of hanging down, a bit clear of the edge. He said, and there were no chains or ropes or anything like that visible. And I think he said there was some oil running down the side of the Cessna. And he thought this might have been ingested. If there was some air intake underneath or something, that heat and flame coming out was just air burning, wouldn't it? Something like that. Anyway, he scratched the registration number on the tractor with a nail. He said, next time I come up, I'll give you the number. And he did. And he'd written it. I've got it written down in the shop in a book. And the interesting thing is it was the day following when that plane went missing between Victoria and Tasmania. You know, when that plane rang up and he said there were lights around him. And now Bill Chalker says, oh, Frederick Valentich, yeah. And Laurie says, yeah. Bill says, so that would put it back about October 1978. I said, yeah, it was the day following. Anyhow, he said this thing moved off in the direction of where the military manoeuvres were. He said it was kind of went over a ridge, and he said that was last he saw of it with this high-pitched sound. And in the book on page 93, I've done a simulated model to sort of make it look like what it might have looked like for this farmer who saw this disc with his aeroplane stuck to the side of it. I've tried to sort of do a mock-up photo so people can see what it might have looked like. So, what a story. It's amazing.
What a story indeed. And when I read that, like, my jaw actually dropped because it is just such a surreal piece of this mystery that this plane goes missing over the Bass Strait, which is, you know, it's not like it's super far away from Adelaide, but stuck to the side of this UFO. It's mind-blowing.
The thing was, I think because of that funny noise and everything, I think that they've actually collided. They've somehow come together over the ocean, mid-air. That's why nothing was ever found in the sea. And this witness has seen it the next morning, stuck to the side of this flying object. Now, there's also, as you would have read in the book, there was this TV, this fellow who was it? TV camera operator for one of our TV channels, I think it was Channel 7, but he lived in Adelaide, but he remembers when he was a little kid, about 6 or 7 years old, he and his brother woke up one morning, it just happened to be 1978, October 78, and they heard this funny noise and they looked down and there was this big circular object hovering outside the house, but it was making a funny noise and that's what woke them up. Now, it may have still had the Cessna stuck to it, I don't know, but it could be the same thing that Laurie described seeing, which would have possibly been later that same day. I don't know. We can't get like an exact date or anything, but it was October 78th.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of a bit of corroborating evidence, but it's not, you know, you can't really directly link it, but it's very interesting. But that's, yeah. Oh, the other thing was too, because Laurie said, oh, it was near where the military thing was going on. Well, we've checked that out. We've got contacts that are actually involved in the Australian Army, and they looked up that date, and there was a military exercise going on at Murray Bridge in South Australia.
That was going to be my next question, because I wonder what if there was any type of military connection to the ongoings of what was happening here.
The witness said that it flew off towards where there was an army exercise going on. That weekend, it flew over that area, and there is an army base down there. I've driven past it, I've seen it. So apparently, it flew over there. I wonder if there's any military guys who were doing that exercise who saw this strange object fly over.
Yeah, it'd be really fascinating. I would absolutely love to see if anyone who listens to this podcast was around that area and saw something that happened, because you'd be surprised, dear George, that the people that listen to this podcast, it's so varied, and they come from all kind of ways of life. So you never know. We may have a secret contact out there. I would absolutely be over the moon if we were able to kind of scratch a little bit more off the for the mystery of this one. But, you know, this has been one of Australia's greatest aviation and UFO mysteries for 40 years. And the thing that I find so fascinating is that this tape is just not available to the public.
This is the last known spoken word from this guy who's trying to work out what's going on around him, and then he's never been seen. I mean, he's officially missing, presumed dead, you know, so it's that's why they wouldn't release it. And you can understand why the family wouldn't want it released as well, you know. But parts of it have come out. Now, it's... Dr. Haynes came out here, gave a talk in Melbourne. I went to the talk and I recorded his talk, and he didn't play the tape because the family were in attendance that night. So, no, but he went off to Sydney and the family didn't follow him up there. And so he played the tape up there in Sydney. And that is on a website. If you can find it, you can actually hear Haynes giving the talk and running the Valentich tape and discussing it, and you hear Fred's voice. You hear Fred saying, oh, it's in front of me right now. you hear all of that on the tape, on the Haynes talk. It's on Audio Mac. I think that's the website, Audio Mac. I can send you a link to it. So
actually, if you could, that would be great, because I can include it in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, so yeah, people can hear the actual recording being discussed by Dr. Haynes.
Right. But I do have to ask you, George, and it might be like a bit of a speculative question, but before I kind of let you go tonight, what do you think happened that day?
What do I think happened? Well, I think that he's encountered, just like Steve Roby does, he's encountered something very unusual that he couldn't even describe it. And I think they've actually collided midair. That's why no wreckage was found. But what's happened beyond that, other than what the farm said, there was something attached to the aircraft. I don't know what the final answer is. I'd love to find the farmer, talk to the farmer who saw it. He may still have an old tractor with the number scratched on the paint. You know, I'd love to see that if that exists. But I don't know. Mate. Look, I think there was an accidental aerial collision between this large object and the plane. I think that the farmer's description of this plane stuck to it with oil running down the side, but and that is quite an alarming thing. But it explains why nothing was found, nothing washed up in the sea. You know, if you drop a plane into the ocean, parts do wash up. Now there was an air intake cowling, which turned up on a beach, but it was over 350 kilometres from where Fred's last known position was. And it was against the current. So this non-buoyant piece of aluminium air intake would have had to flow against the sea current for 5 years and then end up right near the airport runway on Flinders Island to be from the same plane. It couldn't possibly be from...
Doesn't make sense, does plane. It?
No, but that's why I did a fair bit about that in the book too, because that was in the official records that were kept for this case. And the skeptics jump on that and say, oh, well, there you go, it's been solved. A bit of wreckage washed up, so he must have got into the sea. But what about the guy who saw it the next day and it was flying around attached to this large object? Yes. How do you work out what happened? I don't know if we'll ever know. My main reason for writing the book, Nothing on Radar, The Flintish Mystery, my main reason for writing that was to defend Fred, because a lot of... you see a lot of stuff online where people are attacking him and saying, oh, look, he was a bad pilot. I mean, yeah, he had a few misdemeanors. He was only a young guy. He was 20 years old. He was learning to fly. He made a few mistakes. He got reprimanded for flying into cloud at one stage. He accidentally flew into restricted airspace over Sydney. He'd never been there before. You know, he was learning. People make mistakes. That's how you learn. You make mistakes. He didn't pass all of his exams on the first go. Well, not everybody does. You resit the exam and you study and you resit the exam, and when you pass, then you go on to the next level. And that was his reason for going down to Cape Otway, was to up to King Island, was to get a few more hours up, because all pilots do that. They've got to get their experience up. Unfortunately, Fred had a very unusual experience. And I'm very pleased with how the book's turned out, and I published it on Amazon because it's almost impossible to get publishers to look at your work.
Yes, it's
self-publishing. Self-publishing cuts through all of that. It's revolutionary because they print on demand. Somebody, a couple of months ago, somebody ordered a copy in Italy, so Amazon printed one book in Italy and gave it and sent it to them.
Wow, that's incredible.
They print on demand. There's no warehouse full of books that somebody had to pay for, and then you've got to try to sell them all.
There you go. So, how fascinating.
It's revolutionary. So if somebody goes to Amazon, looks for the book and orders it, they'll print it in a day or two and they'll have it in their hands in a couple of days, freshly printed.
Wow, that blows my mind. That's incredible.
It is fantastic. Maybe we should do an audible version too. People have asked me, please do an audible one Well, that's a big project. That'll take me a couple. That's going to be a year to do Audible, because an Audible recording could go for 10 hours, you know, even a short book could take a long time. But I'm not against the idea. I think it's a good idea. I've done a Kindle version, so if people don't want to carry a book around or have a book on a bookshelf, you can just read it on your phone. You can get the Kindle version. That's also on Amazon. So
yeah, absolutely. This is one that I'm definitely going to add into my library in a physical sense. I'm usually a digital book reader. I have hundreds on my iPad, but ones like this, I think they'll hold a lot of weight in the future. And I don't think my iPad's going to last forever, but I know a book will. So I'm very interested in getting a physical copy of that. I might have to ship it to you, get you to sign it for me or something there, George.
Oh, yeah, I'll do that. No worries. Look, happy to do that. I've thought about this every day. Yeah, I think about it every day because since it happened, I saw the plane on his way to his final strange encounter. And yeah, so it took me 40 years of thinking about it before I started writing. And then 4 to 5 years to finish the book. So,
and I think you've done an outstanding job with it, George. Absolute captivating read for me. It was extremely eye-opening in how many personal connections and the damn plane being stuck to the side of this craft was the most mind-blowing thing I've read in a long time. So I highly recommend anyone who listens to this podcast, you know, head over to Amazon. I'll put links in the show notes for anyone who wants to check it out. It's not an overly long book. It's about 164 pages from memory. So it's a really good one to sink your teeth into over a weekend. And you'll learn some really great history about one of Australia's most intriguing aviation incidents.
Yeah, well, it was good fun writing it. It took a while, but it was good fun. I was doing other things as well, of course. I'm working full time and I'm doing other stuff as well, but that's other stuff. But yeah, that's part of me.
Yeah. But George, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, is there a good way for them to reach out for you if they potentially have any additional information relating to this case or anything like that?
That would be fantastic. I can give you my email address because people could email me. They can send me an email. That is probably the best way. I'm on Facebook, so you can find me on Facebook. It's just my name, George Simpson.
What we'll do there, George, is we won't get you to put it out right on the podcast because if people do want to contact you, we'll put it in the show notes and they can reach out to you that way. But fun. I tell you what, George, it's been a real treat chatting to you tonight. It's been super eye-opening, and I personally just want to thank you for, you know, writing about one of the most intriguing UFO cases in Australia's history.
You know, it's a pretty good one. I'm pretty pleased with it. Yep. It's a pretty good case. It's a pretty unique case. And look, the family still have no closure. Frederick's grandmother is still alive. She's in her mid-90s. She still doesn't know what happened to her grandson. His mother is still alive. His younger brother and two sisters are still alive. His father died, unfortunately, some years ago. But I knew him quite well because he used to come to UFO meetings looking for answers, and he never got any answers, sadly. He never found the answer he's looking for.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Believe Paranormal and UFO podcast. If you have had an encounter and you would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to follow us on all our social media outlets and be sure to join our Discord server to talk to other listeners of the show. You'll find all these links in our show notes. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.